kids eat on our hot dogs.
Fat kids, skinny kids, kids who climb on rocks.
Hello. You are listening to FSCK, the Corporate Media, Edition 21. This broadcast includes a soundscape, or as they say in Adam Curry land, what does he call it, that silly man, he calls it a sound-seeing tour. Who invented that word? I bet it was Adam, with 4 2x4s strapped to my ass. I'm flying by the goggles of my silly-looking haircut. At any rate, I digress. Okay, this edition is going to be kind of a soundscape, mainly because I'm in my trailer, and my heating source is one of those ceramic fans. So every once in a while, it's going to come on, and it's going to blow, and I'll be able to get rid of some of it using noise reduction, but some of it's still going to be there. So, without further ado, I'd like to dedicate this to a group that we've been asked not to call the Auburn Three, but three people who were arrested and snitched upon by a fourth person. We won't mention her name, right? Anna Davies? Oh, yeah. Oh, so, three people. I dedicate this particular edition to them. Instead of media minutes and assorted other doodads and widgets and whatever else. What I figured I would do is I would read an entire chapter from Abby Hoffman's South End Press book, Square Dancing in the Ice Age. Okay, with little ado. I have a book recommendation, besides this one, of course. You should go out and buy or at least download the PDF of The Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent, a National Lawyers Guild report on government violations of First Amendment rights in the United States. I believe it's $10, brand new, from North River Press. The book was published last year by Heidi Bogosian, and the foreword is by Lewis Lapham. I guess I should report on my bias this second. I am plugging this book. I'm written up in page 87 and 88. So, of course, I would be partial to this book were it written well, or hateful of this book were it written poorly. It's a good read. But this chapter I'm about to read to you is even better. It's called The Town Too High to Die, and again, it's written by Abby Hoffman. When you're a fugitive, the highway's your home, sings the cowboy on the radio, roaming from town to town, wishing you could settle down. Those dreams are pretty strong at times. No different from everyone else's desires, though. A nice, out-of-the-way place in the country. Fresh air, no traffic, cheap living, and good people. Above all, good people. Folks you could trust. Who wouldn't turn you in, no matter how high the price on your head? I think I know a place. It's way out west, high in the mountains, where it should be. It's got a wild past and a wild future ahead. Folks up there have done some struggling over long hours, and the work they've put in may give us down here in the valley some ideas on the possibilities of different ways to live a good life. One thing I know for sure, it's one of the few places I could say my name and spend as much time as I damn well please. It warms a hunted man's heart just to know the place exists. Up there in the mountains between Albuquerque and Santa Fe, there's a new town a-growing, a new vision, if you please. It's a place they call Madrid. Central New Mexico is surrounded by the legends of the Old West. South of Madrid lives Lincoln County, set of the bloody wars in which Billy the Kid made his name. Pat Garrett rode through these hills tracking the young. To the west lay the lands of the Apache, where Chief Nana and Cochise led their braves in the staunchest resistance to the white man's intrusion. To the north, the end of the Great Santa Fe Trail in Rayado, founded by the renowned Christopher Kit Carson in Cimarron, home of the Colfax County Wars. To the east, La Mojarra, at one time called the Sodom of the West, so famous for its gambling dens and whorehouses, and Las Vegas, where it was said that in the 1870s a bandit a week was hung from the windmill in the center of town. Through these mountains came the likes of Jigaboo Jones, Pegleg Dick, Scarface George, and Split Nose Mike, brawling, slugging down their Taos Lightning.
robbing payroll trains and outrunning the posse sometimes. These hills were boom country, treasures of the mountains for those with enough ambition, guts, and good fortune. 1,500 years of mining history buried in its rock slides. From Pueblo-dwelling Indians scraping the earth for turquoise to the present where fancy Caltech professors prowl the hills with Geiger counters searching for untapped uranium. It was here over 300 years ago, Spanish up from Mexico came in search of El Dorado, their city of gold. They didn't find much, but gold was there all right. And silver and copper and tin and lead and potash and mica and coal. There is no mountain in New Mexico not rich in minerals. And no area is richer than these mountains. By the middle of the 19th century, the rush was on. Gold was discovered in Golden, and Dolores, silver in Cerillos, and boomtowns sprung up overnight. Bonanza, Carbonetaville, San Pedro, and Madrid. Madrid didn't yield much gold. It may still be up there, say the old-timers. You need tons and tons of water to mine gold, and Madrid never had much of that, one explains. What Madrid did have, however, was coal. In fact, it was one of the few places in the world where hard and soft coal could be mined simultaneously. And close to the surface, too. Easy pickings. Coal was mined successfully off and on for 80 years in Madrid. By 1928, it was lugging more coal than almost any place in the West. 3,000 miners lived in drab, wooden shacks stacked in neat rows along the slopes of the hills. Mostly, they worked the winter so they could melt the snow for drinking water. Work and living conditions were wretched. They got more black lung than money for their pains. When the 30s entered, wobblies and communists worked these hill towns trying to organize the miners. Violent battles erupted between workers and hired company guards. The Ludlow Massacre on the Colorado border and the Gallup coal strike to the west were just two of the better-known clashes. In Madrid, there was constant agitation and fierce resistance. In addition, there were fires that would spread rapidly through the dry coal-rich fields, igniting the wooden houses like kindling. Eventually, the mine owners closed down most of the production. It wasn't just the strikes and fires. The diesel was replacing the steam engine. Americans were starting to heat their homes with oil, and overnight, huge natural gas deposits in the southwest part of the state were discovered, rendering mining towns like Madrid relics of the past. Bustling communities became ghost towns, except for a brief respite during World War II, when the mine was reactivated to supply the secret city of Los Alamos, Madrid lay dormant. Tumbleweed blew through the deserted houses. Paint peeled from the boards, porches sagged, and roofs collapsed. Old Santa Fe steam engine 874 rusted to its tracks beside a pile of unhauled coal. A few diehards stayed on, running a beat-up gas pump, a cantina, and a mine museum. The town with all its ghosts, huddled against the windswept mountains, black as the soot on a coal miner's back, Madrid huddled and waited. Till now. For most of its active life, the town was owned by the Albuquerque and Cerillos Mining Company, which underwent several changes in name and management through the years. In 1938, Oscar Huber was given supervisory control of the area, and 10 years later, he bought the land outright. After failing at an attempt to reactivate the mine in the early 50s, Oscar died and ownership passed to his son, Joe Huber. Joe tried to sell the whole town, lock, stock, and barrel, several times. In 1964, Billy Sol Estes tried to buy the place, but negotiations floundered when Billy was hauled off to prison. In 1973, Joe announced he had sold it to a big California land broker, but in August, that deal also fell through. Joe really wanted to sell off the 360 acres and house lots. He was raised in Madrid and wanted to preserve its picturesque character rather than see it turn into some lackluster land. He wanted to sell to people who would fix up the place but respect its historic roots. Problem was, New Mexican law prohibited subdivision in small units. A hustling real estate agent plowed through dusty old land survey charts up in Santa Fe and found that for a brief spell, Madrid had been an official town named Kellyville and had, in fact, already been subdivided. The way was open, and in February 1974, Joe Huber put the 160 lots, each with a sort of house on, up for sale. By then, there were already 50 or so hardy souls who had been semi semi-renting, semi-squatting on the property. Joe had affinity for these people. They and he shared the kind of faith that moved mountains, so to speak. He offered them first pick of the lots. Prices were arranged so even the poorest could afford to buy in. Some as low as $50 down and $50 a month. For $2,000 paid over 2 years, former dropout anarchists who had sought refuge in these rough mountains were turned into bona fide homeowners. The original dwellers, learning of the sale, ran to call kindred spirits in Albuquerque and around the country. In 2 weeks, all the lots were sold. Joe donated the ball field, the tennis courts, the church, and the waterworks. He kept control of the museum, the mineshaft tavern, and mining rights. The last, a common and anxiety-producing aspect of most Southwest land deals. Many of the lots were snapped up by speculators and Albuquerque families who wanted a weekend retreat at 3 to 4 times the original $2,000. But the majority were taken by folks who were dedicated to settling the place on a year-round permanent basis. One of the originals, Carol, put it this way. When the place went up for sale, we ran around like chickens without heads. No one felt we could take on the responsibility. I don't think there were more than 3 or 4 of us over 25. The past 3 years have been tough, but almost everyone stuck it out. The original settlers wanted to establish a new town with values, principles, and structures different from where they had come from. Exactly what and how was not clear, but different anyway. We had all gone through the rat race we hated with a passion. Bureaucracies, cops, courts, bosses, said one of the founders. In fact, no one attending that first meeting even favored making it a town. What they did do was form a landowners association with automatic membership for all. That was the condition Mr. Huber laid down to all of us, explained the association's head, Diane Johnson. Next, we drew up a governing document, the covenants. Mainly, it prohibits construction not in character with the place, things like condominiums and other structures. It also spells out some committees, such as water, sewage, and legal, the barest elements of government. Mostly, we make decisions at 4 town hall meetings held throughout the year. Bureaucratic control is pictured as the great internal evil. A former government worker now on the water committee put it this way. If there's one thing everyone has in common, it's hatred of power trips. We're probably over-paranoid whenever the subject of rules or leaders comes up. Many of us worked for the government in the Peace Corps or poverty program, and we saw bureaucracy kill even the most elementary form of initiative. That was 1973. Today, the town is far from a ghost town. All around, you can hear the sound of hammers and saws. Amid the rows of dilapidated shacks, people have restored and renovated nearly 100 dwellings. Souls like Fred Bloom, who fled Philadelphia and a high-paying job as a systems analysis consultant to pioneer in Madrid. Fred's sparkling robin's egg blue house with its hardwood floors, new roof, porch, handmade furniture is the shape of things to come. Fred's away, but a neighbor tells me Fred did most of the work himself. He probably got it all. House, land, and renovations for $5,000. It's way more than livable. Some have done it for much less. George, an ex-school teacher from New York City, came out here 10 months ago and landed a good deal. I got a house and fixed it all up for under $3,000. I only pay $12 a year in taxes. I won't make $2,000 a year teaching at our school, and even with food stamps, that's not a lot of money. Even so, George insists he'd never go back to New York. The survival problems, getting water up to the house, keeping warm in the winter, are tough, but it's a good life, worth a little sacrifice. Come hell or no water, George echoes the determination of the nearly 200 residents to stick it out. Winter has come to the hills of Madrid. It's 6,000 feet up here. There's a thin cover of snow on the ground. Looking out over the hills, you can see the restored houses, their new green or red roofs sparkling in the bright sun. The morning fires have already been struck. The sweet smell of piñon burning in the wood stoves lingers in the crystal clear air. The sound of a triangle ringing summons the children to school. Knots of laughing children are seen everywhere. Tough, bright-eyed kids with long hair, jeans, and work boots. Just the type of kids you'd expect of a rough mountain camp where the average citizen hides the fact that he or she has a master's degree tucked away in the trunk. The children's workshop is located in the old church on the hill. It has 2 full-time teachers like George, and each parent comes to work as an aide once a week. In addition, they pay $17 a month tuition for each of 32 kids attending school. It's accredited, non-profit, and takes children up to 12. Teenagers are bused into Santa Fe, and one just began going to the university down in Albuquerque. Down the valley on Main Street, we find the nerve center of the town. To the left, a Volkswagen repair shop with a mechanic so good and cheap that almost everyone in town drives an old Volks bus. To the right, behind a clothing store where the woman announced a private sale because of my friendly face, lies the Madrid Fire Department. The chief, he's Ed Boniface, who took over from Linda Snearley. All positions such as these are filled by volunteers. If more than one person volunteers, votes are taken at the town meeting. There's a fire truck parked in the garage donated by the Forest Service. Like many of the town institutions, the fire department was formed out of crisis. Explains the chief, last spring we had a bad fire. Five or six houses went up like matchsticks. Jack Olson, the blacksmith, was killed. It was the driest part of the year. The well was pumping less than 2 or 3 gallons a minute. We were damn lucky the whole town didn't go up. For that crisis, the community needed bailing out by the National Guard. Now they've fixed up the old railroad tank to hold an emergency supply of water. Thanks to that and a series of drills and instructions by a team of rangers, all subsequent fires have been nipped in the bud. The blacksmith's death has been the only one so far in the town's new history. On the other hand, 18 births have been recorded. A girl named Morning Star, born to the McQuiston family, was the first child to be born in Madrid in more than 20 years. It was an event the whole town celebrated. Children are real important to the town, and all around you can see hand-painted flowery signs saying, "Drive slow, we love our children." There's an abundance of swings and slides, and most stores sell penny candy and small toys. Kids pester and often get freebies, reminiscent of those familiar scenes in the Western movies with the kindly storekeeper. Aside from one commune, the Dobie Ducks, a few bachelors, and some women sharing house, almost all the homes are occupied by traditional nuclear families. There's a lot of pregnant women to be seen about, and kids everywhere, even in the town saloon. The Mineshaft Tavern, like every store in town, has something of everything. In addition to an Olympic-sized drinking bar catering to the needs of thirsty townfolk and travelers, it features better-than-average New Mexican food, a large fireplace, and the only color TV set in town. There are two pool tables discreetly tucked in a back room and something called the Haunted Mineshaft, a spook house for kids, off to one corner. More than a few of the drinkers in their scraggly beards, cowboy boots, and hats look like they might have fit in during any period of the town's wild and woolly past. A sign over the bar reminds patrons that possession of firearms in a tavern is a fourth-degree felony. There's a bandstand along the right wall, and four nights a week there's live music and dancing. Charlie, a local drummer, informs me that the town has a disproportionate number of first-rate musicians. Okay, really good soundscape. Now you're going to start hearing some bona fide Oregon rain. Groups like the Ramblers doing country and Night Flyer playing reggae rock make Madrid their base as they bop from gig to gig through the Southwest. Last summer there were free jazz concerts given every Sunday, and it was down the road in the ball field. The ball field hosts one of the best-loved institutions, the town softball league. And like everything else in Madrid, it has its own personal history. Back in the 30s, the Chicago Black Sox ruled the major leagues with such power that the only financial future the players could envision was to join together with some local gamblers and start fixing the scores for the games. When they were caught, the baseball world exploded in a rage. It was the country's worst sports scandal. Half dozen or so players changed their names and disappeared into the West. All of a sudden, this little-known mining town in the New Mexican mountains was the powerhouse of the formidable Texas League. Most folks put two and two together. No one minded then, and no one would today. We still have our outlaw element, claimed a scruffy-looking gent. I'm not saying who or what, but let's say much of what is illegal out there is legal up here. Later, Mel Johnson told me, we're all fugitives trying to get away from something. Most people have monikers like Bullfrog or Domingo or Rocky Mountain. If you've got a name, it's generally a first name or it's made up. People tend to talk about the future more than the past. We already know everyone's anti-government. We don't like America's wars, its attitude towards its own land and people, and we fled the great money grab. Farther down Main Street, you pass a row of shops catering to the tourist trade. Ceramics, paintings, and antiques. La Modista, which manufactures modern garments with a Southwest desert flavor, ships to more than 20 stores throughout the country. Most residents see this type of enterprise as the future of Madrid. Our future lies with artists, craftspeople, and writers. People that can make something and sell it someplace else, as one of the shop owners. Tourism, although important to the town, is not that important. In fact, in the past few years, because of the recession and gas shortage, fewer and fewer tourists make their way to Madrid. But tourists come and are treated hospitably. Things get, well, they can get out of hand, mentions one townie. A group of tourists came through town last year, and one went into my house. The people are proud they never locked their doors. Next thing I knew, she was holding my frying pan in her hand and asking me the price. Can you beat that? They thought the whole town was an antique and everything was for sale. In the center of town is the entrance to the Mine Museum, where for a dollar, Johnny Ochoa, the oldest resident and chief storyteller of Madrid, will guide you around the abandoned mine works. Farther down, there's the general store run by Vicky Van Dusen from Connecticut. It also serves as a post office, town meeting hall, and health clinic. A mobile, rural medical team comes by every Thursday. One can't say it's a big profit maker. In fact, today it's closed, and Vicky's off in Albuquerque trying to beg up a loan to keep the place going until summer when business picks up. There's a used clothing depot and a place called the Madrid Artists and Craftsperson Co-op. Some goats are tied up in front of another craft shop. Cats and dogs lie in the street. People have tried all sorts of businesses, independent capitalism, like a carpet store, down to all types of cooperatives you can think of, explained Mel and Diane Johnson, who own Lo Modista. The town's most commercially successful business. Naturally, we all favor the development of cooperatives, and there's more shared living here than probably anywhere else in America. But some of us wanted to open our own stores. Now we have a policy of trying to support our local shops. It's hard, though. We're all living on marginal incomes. Probably 75% are getting some form of assistance. Mostly, we find it's cheaper to buy food and gas from the big outlets in Santa Fe. You know, a couple of dollars different is important when you're poor. None of the people living here, not even the merchants, are what you'd call your money-grubbing types. Not for 40 years has anyone moved to Madrid to make money. One resident put it this way. On the one hand, there's the temptation to sell out at a good profit because the land values have tripled since we came here. And on the other hand, there's the rough life hauling water and wood, putting in time digging wells or septic tanks with your neighbor. We're pioneers, all right, but we didn't come out here to strike it rich. What then keeps the people here? Mostly it's the other people. People with strong ideas on matters like ecology. Almost every family uses recycled water, is experimenting with solar energy, and tries their luck at organic gardening. It's a highly educated group that dreads specialization. Enough so to force themselves to learn carpentry, mechanics, irrigation, and a host of other manual skills. In addition, they've had to educate themselves in the ways of the paper jungle, learning everything there was to know about water rights, township charters, federal and state assistance programs. There are people content to work in the hotels and restaurants of Santa Fe or start a small pottery business and put a good hunk of their energy into the community and the land. We're all scrounging. We know where there's some stolen wood for sale cheap, who's the most sympathetic welfare worker in town, and where there's an apple orchard that needs picking. We scrounge and we share, explained a guy working on a new solar system from a design he just received from the University of California. New Mexico ranks 46th in per capita income. It's the poorest state in the Union, with the exception of four deep south states. So it comes as no surprise that many of the people here receive federal assistance. It doesn't mean the people lie around. Far from it. Dorsal Woods, who came here 5 years ago from the east to get his value realigned, said he worked every day either on his house or a neighbor's. We're working real hard. We figure we get what we put into the place. No more, no less. There's no place else I'd want to live. Dorsal's a cabinet maker now. Back then, well, all the residents seem to have similar stories. Good educations, urban culture, careers, and dreams of sticking it, all in the blender and starting life anew. Mel Johnson's story is more typical than not. I was an administrator of the Chicago Art Institute. I wore a beard and drove an old Chevy van with Peace and McCarthy stickers on it. Then came the convention in '68. I got three moving violations and had my license suspended in 1 month. Cops hassled me every day. I started to get more radical, more pissed. When Kent State happened, I organized a peaceful march and some right-wing bastard tried to deliberately run me over in the street. Right after that, I came out here with a group of people to start an environmental design school up in the hills. The school went down the tubes, but Diane and I were determined to stick it out. Some of us moved down here to Madrid and started fixing it up. That was 4 years ago, and we're still here. Francis and Jerry Lee had similar stories. Francis tells them, Larry came out of Vietnam angry. He had been sent to die and kill needlessly. He was a founder of Vietnam Vets Against the War, and he also started First Casualty Press, which put out Free Fire Zone and other books by soldiers who had fought there. Myself, I worked in Vista and in the Missouri school system. We came here to make a new life and to share it with people we like. We feel good about things because we're at a point where we feel we have a real say about our environment and our community. We all have a real sense that the future is ours. We change for sure. When we first got here, we were diehard anarchists. Next thing you know, we're homeowners attending meetings about fire insurance and septic tanks. We're still pretty united around the ideals that brought us out here. There's strong pressure to build our community our own way. Francis and Larry run the Pack Rat's Nest gas station in town and are determined to make a go of it. They've built a greenhouse, and Larry plans to start the press up here again. So far, the community has not taken the easy route. Incorporation as a legal municipality would make federal and state funds available for a good waterway system, school subsidies, and a host of other benefits. Taxes, small as they are, could go to their own town rather than to the county or state as they now do. They could gain jurisdiction over a five-mile radius around Madrid. Extremely important given the horde of land developers grabbing up the hills around the town. To an outsider, it seems like an easy decision. Not so, say the residents who've examined it more closely. There's no one really pushing incorporation. In order to get outside help, we have to structure ourselves like the outside. We have to set up a government, political leaders, cops, inspectors. It's probably inevitable, but right now we're on another trip. All of us, says Francis. Grove Burnett, a Santa Fe attorney who often stands between Madrid and much of the outside world, sees water as the town's biggest headache. No one knows how much there is or how long it'll last. There are state funds ready to be made available once they establish water rights. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1972 allows federal money to come in on a 60-40 sharing basis, but they have to get better organized. Lack of water could sink the town. I'm not saying it'll happen. I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I'm a lawyer. Tom Andrew, a Santa Fe engineer, has put in some time trying to solve the water problem. And recently, a team of environmentalists from the University of New Mexico began working on a comprehensive energy proposal. Mostly, however, the people have relied on their own imagination, resources, and willingness to battle a cold, cruel outside world. I don't want to seem paranoid, but we are surrounded by institutional enemies, said a member of the legal committee. We fought Mountain Bell for over a year on just getting one public payphone. The town has six private phones in here. We need a public phone for emergencies. The Federal Communications Act of 1934 ensures adequate service regardless of economic status or geographical location. They say the phone won't pay for itself, but under law they must install it. I called Sheriff Paul Boca, under whose jurisdiction Madrid falls, but declined a face-to-face interview. Residents say, however, that the county sheriff's office more or less ignores them, and they seem to be able to handle law and order problems themselves. Someone recalls a car of Tufts shooting at a house once, but general opinion has it that this was an isolated individual act. People insist there's no crime such as robbery or assault. Occasionally you'll see guns in a house or mounted in a truck, but violence, everyone claims, is practically non-existent. Our biggest enemies are the land developers and the mining interests, Mel Johnson tells me. Every day new lots are sold between here and Santa Fe, here in Albuquerque. These lots need wells, and wells drain the water shelf. It's like pulling the plug out of the bathtub. One huge nightmare I have is to wake up one morning in a few years, look out from our groovy little town here, and see we've been surrounded by the suburbs. The mining industry presents an equally big threat. Occidental Petroleum has begun the preliminary steps that soon will lead to extensive copper mining in nearby Cerritos. They planned to mine using the largest tonnage of explosives ever detonated in peacetime anywhere. Those blasts could literally shake down the town, a former engineer from California told me. Besides that, they'll use 100 times the water all the people from here to Santa Fe require. Environmentalists and homeowners are holding regular meetings organizing against the mining operation. It's too early to say who will win out, but the history of New Mexico is a history of corporation plunder. Environmental groups already have their hands full battling efforts to turn one of our most beautiful states into a nuclear waste garbage dump. In addition, there are 50 million tons of coal beneath the surface of Madrid. President Carter is known to favor reintroducing coal into the nation's energy program for the next few years, and folks could wake up to another nightmare someday. To the sound of excavators and earth movers digging up their organic gardens, I asked Mel Johnson how they would handle a crisis like that. We'd fight. We'd use lawyers and sit-ins, and some might use guns. There are people here who've had all that in their backyards. Our first line of defense would be to build support of environmental groups and go to court. We're building something, something worth defending. Evening comes early in these hills. Long, eerie shadows reach out from the tall, black peaks, crawl across Main Street, and stretch into houses. On some hilltops are huge wooden scaffolds, erected half a century ago to hold the most spectacular display of Christmas lights in all the West. They stand unlighted, half-fallen, like signalmen with arms outstretched. The sun lays down the richest of sunsets. Vivid pink, purple, and orange clouds extend to the distant snow-capped peaks of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The landscape is perfectly still, majestically beautiful. Leaving Madrid, I couldn't help but feel a tinge of sadness. Just passing the New Mexico State Penitentiary on the road out was reminder enough that I probably could not return here again. But who knows? Being there, I felt romance was being reborn by these new pioneers. In these parts, 100 years ago, it was the custom to leave a pie on the windowsill for the hunted outlaw in the hills. I figured the good people of Madrid might find a way to send up a signal. I'd come back. November 1976. You've been listening to File Syscheck, the Corporate Media, number 21. I was DJ Microbrew, and I read that.